If there's one thing we can learn from reading the Gospels, it's that religion can be dangerous to your spiritual health. In fact, it can be deadly. Just think about it for a moment. I mean, who are the people who were most scandalized by the ministry of Jesus? They were the religious people, the scribes, the Pharisees, the teachers of the law. Who were the objects of Jesus' harshest words of condemnation? They were the religious people, those who were sure of their own righteousness. Who took the lead in seeing that Jesus ended up on a cross? They were the religious people. They stirred up the crowds to cry, "Crucify him, crucify him." And why was that? Simply because they believed that what Jesus was doing, what Jesus was saying, it just wasn't fair. It wasn't right. Jesus was upsetting the world as it was supposed to be. Jesus didn't deal with people as they deserved. This kingdom that Jesus came to bring turned the moral order of the whole universe upside down. And we looked at this a couple of weeks ago, didn't we, in that story that Jesus told about workers in the vineyard. The owner of the vineyard paid the people who'd only worked 1 hour the same as those who worked the whole day. And the people who were hired first, they were pretty upset about it. They began to grumble against the boss. "We worked in the heat of the day, and they get the same as we do? It's not fair." "What's not fair about it?" The owner responded. "You got your one denarius. Isn't that what we agreed to? Are you envious because I happen to be generous?" Well, this is just what Jesus seemed to be doing, acting like this landowner, lavishly pouring out his blessing on those who had no right to it. And the religious people didn't like it one bit. What kind of a world could Jesus possibly be talking about? Now, the scandal of Jesus' ministry is captured in the first two verses of this chapter that Ed just read, Luke chapter 15. Now, the tax collectors and sinners were all gathered around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners, and he eats with them." The Pharisees and scribes were outraged because Jesus welcomed sinners and ate with them. Now, I used to think that in our age of moral indifference and rigidly enforced tolerance, such an occurrence would hardly engender a violent reaction from anybody. I'm not so sure anymore. Just think of the reaction today if Jesus fraternized with members of the Ku Klux Klan and perhaps even had his picture taken with them. Eating with tax collectors and sinners. That was a serious matter. You see, in the Jewish society of the first century, table fellowship was carefully protected to reflect social and religious boundaries. By the blessing at the meal's outset and the responding amen said by the participants, meals were given a religious dimension. Those who ate at the table were joined together, in a sense, in the sight of God. And by eating together, they all had a share in the blessing. And by implication, they all acknowledged their mutual acceptance by God. So we can understand, for example, the Apostle Paul's hostility toward Peter when he tells us in the book of Galatians that before certain men from the strict Jewish Christian circumcision group came to Antioch, Peter used to eat with the Christian believers, the Gentiles. But when they arrived, he began to draw back and separate himself from the Gentiles of the church, leading others to do the same. Table fellowship, we see, was the chief sign of acceptance and a bond of unity, a unity that Peter, in Paul's opinion, had unnecessarily broken. For the Jews, it was through table fellowship that the ritual distinction between clean and unclean and the moral distinction of the righteous and sinners, it found concrete social expression. Jews were not to eat with Gentiles because they were unclean, and their uncleanness was contagious. It was almost like a child's chicken pox. And this basic understanding was used to make distinctions of moral categories within Judaism also. And so those despised tax collectors and the morally repulsive prostitutes would never be accepted at a gathering of the righteous. And in the view of some, anyone who did not hold to a rigorous life of Torah obedience was forbidden company at the dinner table. But Jesus didn't operate according to those rules. He invented his own. He didn't seem to respect these neat distinctions between the clean and the unclean. After all, Jesus touched a leper. He was uncouth. He was an ill-mannered Galilean. He didn't respect this fundamental division between the righteous and sinners. He welcomed publicans and prostitutes and ate with them. This wasn't just a breach of social etiquette. It was social subversion. It was a scandal to the religious mind. It wasn't right. It wasn't fair. People only get what they deserve. How dare he welcome sinners and eat with them? But don't you see, Jesus said, this is what God is like. And he told them first a story about a faithful shepherd who leaves behind his 99 sheep to go out looking for the one lost sheep. And another about a diligent housekeeper who sweeps the whole house looking for that one lost coin. And in each case, when the sheep is rescued or the coin is found, there is a cause for great celebration. In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents, Jesus says. And that's the context to this famous story I want us to look at. A familiar story whose very familiarity may cause us to miss one of its main points. Luke chapter 15, verse 11. There was a man who had two sons, Jesus said. And the action of the story begins when the younger son demands his inheritance while his father is still living. And an insulting request, to say the least. Basically, he says, I wish you were dead. He gets the money, and in due order, he leaves home and goes off to a distant country where he squanders his wealth in wild living. Unfortunately for him, the economy goes bad. Verse 14, after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. Think about it. Making a living by slopping pigs is just about the worst thing imaginable for any self-respecting Jew. And he was hungry. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating. But no one gave him anything. And in that sorry state, this young man finally comes to realize how foolish he has been. He comes to his senses, Jesus says. Literally, he comes to himself. It dawns upon him. The light comes on. Reality bursts into his consciousness. How many of my father's hired men have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. So he got up and went to his father. But you know what happens? While the son was still a long way off, his father saw him, and he was filled with compassion. Think about it. This father had been humiliated by the behavior of his son. He had been insulted. He must have been very deeply hurt. His reputation in the community had been defamed. But rather than seeking vindication and retribution against his son, the father absorbed all of that pain himself. His father saw him while the son was still a long way off. The implication is that the father was still looking for him to come back. He never gave up on his son. More than that, we read the father ran out to greet him. Running out, that's a rather undignified thing for a wealthy Jewish man to do. But by so doing, this father spares his son the humiliation and derision he may well have encountered as he walked through that village. The father took all of that shame upon himself by setting aside his own pride, his own honor, leaving his home to run out to meet his son. And before the son, this repentant son, can even deliver his well-rehearsed speech, the father embraces his son. He kisses him. And then verse 21, the son says to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father just throws it off. He immediately calls on his servants to lavish his son with the symbols of love and acceptance, the robe of honor on his shoulders, the ring of authority on his finger. He restores the son's dignity by placing sandals on his bare feet. Go, slaughter the fattened calf, he says. This calls for a great celebration. My son has returned. He was dead, but now he's alive again. Notice the contrast here. Verse 16 is a picture of total rejection in that distant country. No one gave him anything. But now in verse 22 and following, we see a picture of total acceptance. His father gave him everything. What love, what grace is displayed here, what undeserved acceptance. I mean, this son had forfeited any claim he might have had on the father's love, and he knew it. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. And how easily his father might have sent him to the servants' quarters if he allowed him to enter the household at all. How natural it would have been for the father to respond with anger and bitterness and harsh punishment. But Jesus is telling us about a different kind of love. This is a divine love. This is a love that is full of grace, undeserved favor. One might even call it prodigal grace. For that word prodigal means recklessly extravagant, lavishly generous, abounding, abundant. And that's what this was, a prodigal grace. Toward this prodigal son. It's a wonderful story. Just imagine how this son felt. After the anguish that he had caused his father, after the shame of his own foolishness, after the guilt of his own debauchery, in a moment, his father wiped it all away. He was accepted. He was forgiven. He was loved despite all that he had done. Is such grace possible? Or are we forever prisoners of our wayward past, forever condemned for our foolish and sinful actions? Is there no freedom from our guilt and shame? Jesus says there is. For this is what God is like. The God and Father of Jesus Christ is himself a friend of tax collectors and sinners. He receives all who come to themselves and who come home with no claim, no claim at all, seeking only God's mercy. This is who God is, according to Jesus, a God of prodigal grace toward all those willing to accept it. God is like a loving father who wants a relationship with us as his own sons and daughters. He's willing to leave his own home in humility and love to make that possible. And in Jesus Christ, this is just what God himself has done. Like a shepherd looking for the lost coin, like a woman longing for the shepherd looking for the lost sheep, the woman looking for the lost coin, like a father embracing his lost son, God himself comes to us in Jesus Christ. Such is his grace. And again, that grace is available to all who are willing to come to their senses and simply come home to the Father, who will run out to meet them. So I say, how about you? How about you? Have you been wandering in a faraway country? And has your money run out yet? Jesus says, come home. Come home to a loving Father. And when you do, the angels in heaven will rejoice. But I want you to see that's not the end of it. This father had two sons, remember. So Jesus continues the story. Verse 25. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of his servants and asked him, what's going on? Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. You see, this father had two sons. And both of them were lost. Only the second one, the older one, he didn't know it. And that was his problem. For you see, he was a very dutiful son, this one. He was the righteous son. He was conscientious. He was responsible. He always obeyed his father. He always followed the rules. He was the good son. So quite naturally, he expected to receive the father's blessing. He deserved it, you see. So when he heard the music and dancing and was told that it was a celebration for his wayward younger brother, he was incensed. This brother who had been so selfish, so rebellious, so embarrassing to the family honor, why would anyone ever celebrate him? The father was holding a great feast, which probably in those days would have included the whole village. And this older brother first insults his father simply by refusing to join in. And again, the father humbles himself. He goes out to his son. He pleaded with him to join in the feast, But the older brother's views, he views his father's mercy and compassion toward his younger brother as an act of injustice toward him. And he's angry. Instead of some respectful address to his father, he simply says, "Look, listen to me, you. All these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. You never even gave me a young goat to celebrate with my friends. But this son of yours," notice he doesn't refer to him as a brother at all. He's disowned him long ago. "But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." Yes, this son was lost too, but he didn't see it that way. See, both sons had gone to a faraway country, one physically, the other emotionally. But notice this older son, he didn't relate to his father as a father at all. He was just a slave master to be obeyed rather than a father to be loved. But notice the father responds to the older son just as he had to the younger. He extends to him the same fatherly love. He goes out to him, swallowing his own pride. "My son," he says to him, "you are always with me. Everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours, he was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." He urges his son to come and join him in the celebration. But quite abruptly, there the story ends. The younger son had returned, but at the end of the story, the elder brother was still outside. He's left brooding and fuming. And we don't know if he continued in his jealousy and his stubborn refusal to accept his father's gracious love, or if he followed the lead of his brother and came to his senses and joined in the festivities. It's an open-ended story, you see. It's open-ended precisely because the final scene had yet to be written. It was a scene that Jesus' Jewish listeners would have to write for themselves. The lost were being found. Sinners were eating joyously with Jesus. But would his listeners, these Pharisees and teachers of the law, would they enter into that joy? That's the question. Now let's get back to where we began. Religion can be dangerous to your spiritual health. In fact, it can be deadly. Both brothers were selfish and self-centered, but in opposite ways. See, the younger brother was impulsive. He was licentious, indulging his own lusts. And Tim Keller, in his exposition of this passage, suggests we might call him the progressive. Life was about self-discovery, self-expression. It was about exploring alternative lifestyles, pushing the envelope, striving for liberation from all the cultural restraints that come through custom and convention. He was open-minded and tolerant of everyone, except perhaps to those he judged to be closed-minded and intolerant. He wanted to be liberated, free from authority, free to actualize his own identity. But in the end, the only thing he actualized was a hungry stomach and a lonely soul. In contrast, the older son, he was restrained and legalistic. We might call him the conservative. He had a high regard for the order that came through social and moral tradition. Those who differed from his view of the world were dangerous threats to that order. He devoted himself to his father's service, but as a slave rather than a son.
And in the end, he left angry and also alone. You see, both were rebels against the father's love. Both broke the father's heart. But the older brother, he didn't see it. It was hidden to him. He considered himself upright and honorable. He was blind to his own selfishness and self-righteousness. It was, in fact, his moral uprightness that kept him from seeing the truth. He may have been obedient, but it was only to serve himself. He wanted the father's property just as much as the younger brother. He was just using a different method to get it. He was using morality, religion even, as a tool of self-interest. Keller tells a story that illustrates this. He says, once upon a time, there was a gardener who grew an enormous carrot. So he took it to his king and said, "My lord, this is the greatest carrot I've ever grown or ever will grow. Therefore, I want to present it to you as a token of my love and respect for you." The king was touched and discerned the man's heart. So as he turned to go, the king said to him, "Wait, you are clearly a good steward of the earth. I own a plot of land right next to yours. I want to give it to you freely as a gift so that you can garden it all." And the gardener was amazed and delighted and went home rejoicing. But there was a nobleman at the king's court who overheard all of this. And he said, "Oh my, if that's what you get for a carrot, what if you give the king something better?" So the next day, the nobleman came before the king, and he was leading a handsome black stallion. He bowed low and said, "My lord, I breed horses, and this is the greatest horse I've ever bred or ever will. Therefore, I want to present it to you as a token of my love and respect for you." But the king discerned his heart and said, "Thank you," and took the horse and merely dismissed him. The nobleman was perplexed, so the king said, "Let me explain. That gardener was giving me the carrot, but you are giving yourself the horse." How much of our moralism, our good behavior, our religious exercises, our doing good to the poor, service to the needy, how much of it really just for ourselves? Churches can be full of older brothers, you know. Moralistic religion is the default mode of the human heart. Moralistic religion says, if I obey God, God will accept me. The gospel says God accepts me, so I will obey. There's a world of difference between those two. And many Christians, you know, begin by understanding the good news of the gospel, but then they fall back into this moralistic mode. They get judgmental with the tax collectors and the sinners who don't fall in line. They get angry when God doesn't give them what they want, for they've worked hard to earn God's blessing. They're unforgiving toward others because they've forgotten just how much God has forgiven them. They start out amazed at God's grace, but then they fall back into thinking they have earned God's love, and they become older brothers. You see, Jesus knew the deceptiveness of the human heart, the duplicity that hides all forms of hypocrisy. For deep inside, we think that by being religious, being moral, we can put God in our debt. If we do all sorts of good things, he will owe us something. That's how it works, doesn't it? And when God seems to pass out his blessings to mere sinners, our sense of fairness gets offended. What about me? I've been slaving for you all this time. I haven't disobeyed your orders. What's in it for me? And that obedient older brother is not concerned about living in a loving relationship with his father any more than that profligate younger brother. But older brothers don't see it that way. They don't see they have a problem. They don't understand their real sickness. They appear to have all the signs of health, and that's exactly what makes moralistic religion so dangerous. And Jesus seems to be saying that you can rebel against God and be alienated from him by throwing off all the rules or by obeying them diligently. And the religious may have a cancer eating away at their soul, but they can't see it. They seem to be getting along quite well. So they don't seek the one doctor who alone can cure them. Without a sense of their own sin, they feel no need of a Savior. You see, sin, as the Bible defines it, is not just breaking the rules. No, it's putting ourselves in the place of God. It's our trying to live apart from God. And sometimes that may mean obeying the rules so we can manipulate God. And so here's the point Jesus is making. We're all lost. We're all away from home, alienated from the Father. We're all lost. And only when we understand that and accept that the Father stands willing to welcome us, simply by turning to Him with the empty hands of faith, will He receive us as His children. Religion, moralism, it's all about our good works. The God whom Jesus reveals is all about grace, a prodigal grace, a recklessly extravagant and abundant grace, a grace that exceeds anything we can imagine. God's grace is extravagant. There's nothing fair about it. It can't be fair because nobody deserves it. Nobody, and especially me. I know the dangers of religion. Do you deserve it? Do you deserve God's love? No. No, you must understand your need of His grace. You must. Because there is a Father who longs to invite you into His feast. He wants you to share in His joy. He wants you to love you as His own son or daughter. So don't let your past get in the way. Don't let your religion harden your heart. Come to Him. Come home. Let's pray. Lord, what a wonderful message this is.